After that, things quieted down for a short time, and in the middle of February, I took Yoki to stay with my family for a few days, and then I went to Mama and Daddy King's in Atlanta. Martin went to Fisk University in Nashville to give a series of lectures. While we were gone, a Montgomery attorney dug up an old state law against boycotts. The Montgomery grand jury was called and brought an indictment against Martin and about 90 other leaders of the movement. The police immediately began to make arrests. The moment he heard this news, Martin canceled the rest of his lectures and came to Atlanta to pick me up and take me back to Montgomery with him. He went back knowing that he would be arrested. Daddy King was absolutely determined that this should not happen. So unafraid for himself, he was in a state of terror for his son. He gathered a group of friends, Atlanta's most eminent black leaders, to reason with Martin. Martin listened intently to everything they had to say, and then he made his position clear. "I must go back to Montgomery," he said. "I would be a coward to stay away. I could not live with myself if I stayed here, hiding while my brothers and sisters were being arrested in Montgomery. I would rather be in jail 10 years than desert my people now. I have begun the struggle, and I can't turn back. I've reached the point of no return." There was dead silence in the room. All those men knew he was right. The silence was broken as Daddy King burst into tears. He too knew that Martin was right. He had surrendered. He said, "Well, son, you know that what, Daddy?" As soon as we returned to Montgomery, Martin went down to the courthouse with Ralph Abernathy and with Daddy King to surrender himself. The police booked Martin, fingerprinted him, and took a mug shot of him with a number hung on his chest like a criminal. Then he was released on bail. On Thursday, March 22nd, both sides rested their cases. With hardly a pause for consideration, Judge Carter gave the inevitable decision, guilty. He sentenced Martin to pay a fine of $500 or serve 386 days at hard labor. The judge said he was giving Martin a minimum penalty because of what he had done to prevent violence. Many people in the courtroom burst into tears, while others sat with bowed heads. Our lawyers immediately said they would appeal, though they knew it was not much use, and Martin was granted bail. As Martin and I walked out of the courtroom, dozens of friends followed us. Outside, there was a great crowd shouting, "God bless you." Then they began to sing, "We ain't gonna ride the buses no more." Our lawyers not only appealed the verdict against Martin, they also started proceedings in the federal district court to have segregation on the buses declared unconstitutional. The case was heard by a 3-judge panel on May 6, 1956. Martin spoke of the great relief it was for us to be in a federal court where there was an atmosphere less restricted by Southern thinking. 2 weeks later, in a 2-to-1 decision, this federal court held that bus segregation was unconstitutional. The city attorneys immediately appealed the case to the United States Supreme Court. This meant that it would be months before there was any decision. At this point, the city fathers thought up the most dangerous of all challenges to us. On October 30, 1956, Mayor Gale instructed the city's legal department to file such proceedings as it may deem proper to stop the operation of carpools or transportation systems growing out of the boycott. Our lawyers tried to block such a move by asking an injunction in the federal court. They were unsuccessful. A hearing was set for November 13th. Martin and the other leaders were served with subpoenas. As the day approached for the hearing on the carpool injunction, he was apprehensive. He said to me, "You know the people are getting tired. If the city officials get this injunction against the carpools, and they will get it, I'm afraid our people will go back to the buses. It's just too much to ask them to continue if we don't have transportation for them. They will go back." On the night before the hearing, he spoke to a mass meeting, telling the plain truth that an injunction against the carpool would almost certainly be granted. He told the people he did not know if he could ask them to do more. Yet, if they did not, all our months of protest would fail. Then he said, "This may well be the darkest hour before dawn. We have moved all these months with the daring faith that God is with us in our struggle. The many experiences of days gone by have vindicated that faith in a most unexpected manner. We must go on with that same faith. We must believe that a way will be made out of no way." When he came home that night, my heart ached for my husband and for my people. The next morning, November 13, 1956, we were in court once more before Judge Carter. The Montgomery attorneys told the court that the city had lost $15,000 in taxes as a result of the reduction of bus travel and asked for compensation. They further alleged that the carpool was a public nuisance as well as a private enterprise operating without a license fee or franchise. They asked for an injunction against it. The arguments drone on. We all knew that it was just a matter of form. Judge Carter was going to grant that injunction. Then, at just about noon, there was a sudden stirring. Mayor Gale and Commissioner Sellers abruptly left their seats, followed by two of the city attorneys. Several reporters were rushing around. The Associated Press reporter handed Martin a slip of paper, and we were all straining to see. Martin read the note to the people at the table. Then he came running back to me, his face beaming. "Listen to this," he said, and he read aloud. "The United States Supreme Court today affirmed a decision of a special three-judge United States District Court declaring Alabama state and local laws requiring segregation on buses unconstitutional." Many of the people heard Martin reading, and the word passed through the courtroom in a moment. Though court was still in session, there was a great humming and half-whispered talk, and people were moving about. One old man shouted out, "God Almighty has spoken from Washington, D.C." The Supreme Court decision was a crucial landmark, but more basic and more heroic was the influence of the long boycott. Without the unprecedented unity and the determined militancy of the black community of Montgomery, the segregationists would have found the means of evasion as they had for the decades past. On December 20th, 1956, the Supreme Court order reached Montgomery. That day, Mayor Gale announced that he would obey the ruling and maintain order. At a mass meeting that night, Martin reviewed the long struggle and said, "Our faith is now vindicated." He announced the official end of the boycott and urged everyone to return to the buses on a non-segregated basis the next day. The next morning at 5:45, a little group gathered in our living room. Mrs. Rosa Parks, Ralph Abernathy, Edie Nixon, and Glenn Smiley, who was white, came to ride the first desegregated bus with Martin. No one knew what would happen in view of the threats and fury of the white extremists. Reporters and television people waited outside. Like an anniversary of that memorable morning over a year before, the headlights of the 6 o'clock bus flashed down the empty street as it pulled up at the bus stop. The men walked down the steps of our house and through the front door of the bus. The bus driver, smiling broadly, said, in almost a parody of the explorer Stanley's famous remark to Dr. Livingston, "I believe you are Dr. King." Martin said, "Yes, I am." "We're glad to have you with us this morning," the driver said, smiling too, his tenseness gone. Martin thanked him and sat down in a front seat beside Glenn Smiley, the white man. With a clash of gears and a puff of exhaust, the first bus pulled away as though nothing had happened. Martin rode different bus lines most of that day. At his suggestion, other ministers did the same, to be on hand in case of trouble. There was no real disturbance at first, only a few minor instances of rude behavior of whites to blacks. However, it was too good to last. Fury and frustration built up among a few extremist racists. Some nights, buses were stoned and shots were even fired into them. Negroes were dragged off the buses and beaten up. One pregnant woman was shot in the leg. People were taunted and abused. One night, someone fired a small caliber rifle through our front door. Then, on a night in January, there was a concerted guerrilla attack. Ralph Abernathy's house and his church were dynamited. Bob Gretz's home was bombed. Three other Negro churches were bombed, two of them completely destroyed. Martin was deeply affected. On his 28th birthday, Monday night, January 15th, 1957, he spoke at a mass meeting. He pleaded with his followers to receive the violence and to meet it with love. He said that only through love could we survive. After leading the audience in prayer, he intoned, "Oh Lord, I hope no one will have to die as a result of our struggle for freedom in Montgomery. Certainly, I don't want to die. But if anyone has to die, let it be me." The audience was in an uproar, shouting, "No, no." Martin stood in the pulpit, moved by the response, and then went quietly to his seat. Montgomery was the soil in which the seed of a new theory of social action took root. Black people had found in nonviolent direct action a militant method that avoided violence but achieved dramatic confrontation, which electrified and educated the whole nation. It identified the evil, it clarified the wrongs. It summoned the latent strength of the oppressed and provided a means to express their determination, without hatred or abjectly bending their knees. The demand for freedom emerged in strength and dignity. Black people had been waiting for this, and instinctively they seized the new method and opened a new era of social change. Our victory in Montgomery showed the South what could be accomplished by a united effort carried out in a legal, nonviolent way. My husband had become a hero to black people all over the United States. They had long been looking for a genuine and creative leader, and now they turned to Martin. He was conscious of this tremendous responsibility. On September 3rd, 1958, Martin and I went to the courthouse in Montgomery where Ralph Abernathy was to testify in a private case. We were standing in a group just outside the recorder's courtroom when a policeman ordered us to move on. Martin said, "I'm waiting to see my lawyer." The policeman said, "If you don't get the hell out of here, you're gonna need a lawyer." Martin stood his ground. The officer said, "Boy, you done it now." He called another policeman, and together they grabbed Martin, twisted his arms behind him, and pushed him down the stairs toward the city hall. He was kicked and roughed up, and then when they discovered who he was charged with disobeying an officer and released on his own recognizance. When he got back, we had a long talk. Martin knew he would be convicted and fined, but he said to me, "The time has come when I should no longer accept bail. If I commit a crime in the name of civil rights, I will go to jail and serve the time." He asked what I thought, since I would be affected more than anybody else. I assured him that I agreed with him that the time had come for someone to take this risk, and that he was the best person to do so. Martin was responding to the influence of Gandhi and his techniques of non-cooperation. But my husband was becoming firmly convinced that the black leadership must prepare to suffer as Gandhi had. He did not want to go to jail. It was a terrible prospect for a man as sensitive and fastidious as he. We both knew the terrors of southern jails, that over the years many Negroes who had been in prison even for short sentences simply disappeared. However, Martin realized that his imprisonment would arouse sympathy for our movement. He felt that if he asked other people to suffer in the cause, then he, their leader, should be prepared to do so in still greater measure. He said, "You see, this is not the life I expected to lead, but gradually you take some responsibility, then a little more, until finally you are not in control anymore. You have to give yourself entirely. Then once you make up your mind that you are giving yourself, then you are prepared to do anything that serves the cause and advances the movement. I have reached that point. I have no option anymore about what I will do. I have given myself fully." As we had foreseen, my husband was found guilty and sentenced to a fine of $10 or 14 days in jail. He chose to go to jail. Martin's actions caught the judge by surprise. He appeared startled. He said to Martin, "Dr. King, you know you can get out on bail. Wouldn't you like to get someone to pay your fine?" "No, Your Honor," my husband answered. "I do not wish to pay the fine." When the time came for the prisoners who had been sentenced to be taken to jail, Martin followed at the end of the line. When it came Martin's turn to enter the wagon, the prison officials refused to let him in. He went inside again and waited for the second load. The same thing happened all over again. By this time, Martin realized that there was a design to keep him out of jail. The authorities seemed baffled as to how to proceed, but Martin was determined to serve his time. Finally, he was told, "Dr. King, you may go now. Someone has paid your fine." Greatly puzzled, Martin said, "I wonder who it could have been." "It was probably one of your associates," he was told. Martin insisted that this could not be because he had informed his associates of his plans and instructed them not to pay his fine. Martin was persistent in trying to find out how his fine got paid, and finally he was told that an anonymous person had paid his fine. He had no alternative but to leave. Police Commissioner Clyde Sellers had a keener sense of public relations than his subordinates. He realized what bad publicity Montgomery and its public officials would get when the nation learned that Martin Luther King Jr. was in their jail. He paid the fine out of his own pocket and issued a statement that he wanted to save the taxpayers the expense of feeding King for 14 days.